Hi, I'm John Ostrower, editor-in-chief of The Air Current.
I'm Brian Summers, and I write The Airline Observer.
And I'm Brett Snyder, author of Cranky Flyer. You're listening to The Air Show, the podcast where we talk about what goes on in the business of the sky. And guys, I thought we'd get a little Dickensian this week.
What?
Let's do a tale of two cities. Or really, a tale of John's two cities, Boston and Seattle.
Yes, yes, my hometown and my adopted hometown. I love them both dearly.
Which one's better, right now, on the spot?
Yes.
All right, fine.
I will not be drawn into a debate about my two loves.
That's fine. But you hate the Yankees, right?
Well, that's a given.
Sure. Okay. Anyway, so both Seattle and Boston, they do share something here. They have both seen Delta establish hubs over the last decade. But the responses from the incumbents has been, well, it's been pretty different and led to very different outcomes. And so I want to talk about that.
We have a lot to say about this. Alaska has done an impressive job in Seattle, bar none, defending its turf. Well, JetBlue, as we hit on the earlier episode, has not. So Brett's really gone deep on this and looked at the numbers. So, Brett, what'd you find?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, I think it's important to note there are definitely some similarities between what happened in these markets, but there are also a lot of differences as well. And, you know, I think people have talked about this before, but I really want to get more into the nuance today. So I did pull quite a few numbers here out of Cirium data. And, you know, in a sense, this is sort of the playbook, how to beat Delta when they invade your hub podcast.
One thing that we found interesting doing the prep here is that there really isn't one blueprint that works for everyone. So let's get into it.
Let's start in Seattle. Seattle was declared a hub in June 2014 and by Delta. And Seattle, you know, this was Delta's natural Pacific gateway, which they inherited from Northwest. And so they looked at that. They, of course, had been building in LA and wanted a presence there as well. But with United and San Francisco, Delta said, well, this is going to be our Pacific gateway from the West Coast. And then, you know, had that partnership with Alaska to feed that and ultimately couldn't get enough of what it wanted from Alaska. So it said, forget it, I'm going to do it myself. You know, when that was announced in 2014, Alaska did not hesitate. It was, I think it actually was the end of May, they put out a press release saying that they were going to have 11% growth in Seattle. And then they just started adding markets like crazy. They in 2014, they added seven new cities. And then in 2015, they added eight new cities. And they just put the pedal to the metal and said, this is what we're going to do.
And as I remember, there were some weird cities in there, right? Like Seattle, Columbus, Ohio.
How dare you, sir? What is weird about Columbus?
Ooh, okay, no, actually, wait. Columbus, Ohio was a very deliberate choice, actually. It wasn't weird at all. As part of the HQ2 bids that were required from cities bidding for the second Amazon headquarters, you were required to have nonstop service to Seattle. So what happened? Well, Columbus got Alaska to add nonstop service as part of its bid. So that did not come out of nowhere. That was actually a very deliberate. And that's actually a really important point here, because you look at Boston and Seattle and you have to apply the economic changes that went on in both cities. And that's huge. That's absolutely huge here. I mean, the growth of Amazon, the growth of Microsoft, Costco, Starbucks in Seattle, and you've got biotech and pharma and higher ed and healthcare tech expansion in Boston that just absolutely exploded the number of people who were living in these cities. So it wasn't like they were just growing for the sake of growing and people were flying through these cities. They were, because they were hubs for Alaska and Delta and JetBlue as a major operation for them. But I think what's really important to remember is that there was just a lot of people streaming into these cities that was ultimately driving a lot of the fundamentals for growth there, where they were really competing for a different type of passenger that lived there before.
Yeah, and you need to be able to serve their needs, or otherwise, they can take it elsewhere when they have these options. And so that was a big deal. Now, I will point out here, Columbus actually was not until 2019. That was a later one. But in 14, let's see, we have New Orleans, Sitka, Tampa, Albuquerque, Baltimore, Detroit, and Cancun. And then in 15, it was Dulles, Milwaukee, Oklahoma City, Helena, Nashville, JFK?
I think they were in JFK before that. Were they only flying to Newark before that?
You know what? They might have been.
Yeah.
That might be a Virgin America thing. Hmm. I don't know. Anyway, JFK, RDU, and Charleston, which if you want to talk about meeting the business needs of your community, Charleston.
Boeing 787 Express. It's actually Flight 787.
Yeah. Which, you know, so those were the initial growth, but they went from there. They did a ton. And in the first 5 years of the hub, if we look at this, so Delta doubled the number of seats it had from Seattle. It added a ton of new destinations. It was obviously just a huge onslaught. But Alaska, coming off a much higher base, it increased 30% the number of seats it was offering in the first 5 years. That's huge for an airline that was already huge. And, you know, what we see when we look at the share, the seat share in these markets, back in 2005, Alaska was at 49% seat share. And now they're actually in kind of the mid-50s and have been for the last, you know, since the pandemic, basically. So they've maintained their share. And while Delta has gone from, you know, 11.5%, 12% up to 25%. And so they're really sucking the oxygen out of the room here. You have American dropping from, you know, 10 to 5%, United from 15 to 6%, and even Southwest, which had been up over 10%, now down under 5% as well. So it becomes more of a two-horse race in those places.
Yeah, I mean, I think also what you have here is concurrently a huge explosion of international service also. Putting an international hub in the corner of the US, whether it's the left corner or the right corner, what you had for Alaska was building its alliance network to address the obvious strategy that they had, which was that they didn't have international wide bodies. So obviously the end state of that was joining Oneworld. But if you look at the amount of international flying that's happened out of both Seattle and Boston, I mean, hugely enabled through these different strategies at Alaska and Delta, but also the airplanes that were available. I mean, the A330neo for Delta, the 787 opened, you know, Narita, Boston back in 2012. You know, the long-sought Asia service was finally achieved. I mean, Korean used to fly a 777 to Seoul, but they would have to do a fuel stop because the runway was too short for nonstop service out of Boston. So, I mean, you talk about, we like pulled the numbers earlier, like the amount of seats, international seats out of both of these airports has more than doubled in 20 years. I mean, you want to talk about like, well, air travel doubles about every 20 years. Well, yeah, Boston and Seattle are like perfect examples of that.
Really, the international service piece, though, that what's kind of interesting about that to me on the Seattle side here is that this was something Delta could offer that Alaska could not. I mean, sure, Alaska could go out and buy wide bodies, but it wasn't going to do that. Not at the time, at least.
It may be doing that now in a circuitous way.
Right. Well, that, yeah. So now maybe it gets into that business. But in 2014, that was not going to be something that Alaska was even going to entertain. But it knew it had to compete. And especially when we talked about this with some of these really big corporates, right? How do you win that business if you don't serve these places? And I think that was a key part of Alaska's strategy here was the frequent flyer moves. It was creating the broader options for elites. You had, of course, the American tie-in where more reciprocal elite benefits, but then you had joining Oneworld, which gave everyone their Oneworld status benefits on all the different airlines that were going. Let's be honest, Alaska had no choice. If Alaska loses Seattle, Alaska dies. That's especially in 2014, you don't even have the Virgin America flying in California. So, you know, it's an existential crisis here for them, and they rose to it very quickly.
Brett, do you have a sense of what the people in Atlanta think about this? You know, Delta usually does very, very well with its ideas and its strategy. To be 10 years in and to only have 25% market share, I thought that they thought that they were going to push Alaska around. Did you get that idea as well?
Well, as you know, Delta, not so forthcoming with their thoughts. So I can't say I know exactly what they're thinking there. But I do think they probably figured that they might have an easier path than they did. But I'm also not sure internally. I'd be very curious to know what their goals were. If nothing else, Delta is very good at having strategic goals that it sees value for the entire enterprise. And so are they still content with what they have, realizing that it's certainly lagging elsewhere, or not? I don't really know how they feel about it internally, but I would assume that they probably wish it were doing better than it is.
John, I have a question for you as somebody who's on the ground in Seattle. I fly Alaska a lot. I think it's a perfectly fine airline, nothing special. But when you talk to people up in Seattle about Alaska, they're obsessed with this brand. It sounds like there are people who might have a better time flying Delta and they refuse to switch because there's just something about this brand that they're attached to. Are these anecdotes real?
No, they're completely real. They're completely real. And the brand loyalty that Alaska has in Seattle is enormous. Because, well, look, your neighbor is a flight attendant for Alaska, or your friend is a pilot, or, you know, or someone works in corporate or maintenance. It's part of the community. So when Delta kind of rolls into town to wanting to be like, hey, we're Seattle's airline, you know, Seattle would like a word. And so you have that loyalty. You also have the fact that Boeing and Alaska are incredibly, incredibly close. And you have tens of thousands of people in the Seattle area who are working for Boeing. And that relationship is tremendously, tremendously important. I mean, for a long time, there was a lot of unsettled, I don't know if you call it bad, but unsettled relations between Boeing and Delta. And that was around the middle of the ME3 and Boeing's support of Emirates, Qatar, and Etihad and their expansion with wide bodies, and Delta, you know, flipping their lid around that in DC. And then their subsequent order for 350s and 330neos, which definitely changed the trajectory of the relationship again. So I think that, you know, from a kind of a corporate environment here, like that definitely plays into it. But I think that Seattle is obsessive about its brands. They're particularly loyal in terms of how they operate. I mean, Costco is like almost religion here.
Hey, speaking of loyalty, let's pause for a second and talk about our sponsor, PlusGrade.
Brian, I'm almost afraid to ask.
No, ask him. Ask him.
Brian, tell us about your points transactions this week.
So good news, guys, I did not buy any points this week. However, I have tried to transfer points from one program to another. But neither of these companies uses PlusGrade to process the transfer. And it is not working. And it is so frustrating. I wish they used PlusGrade. Look, I know you guys are turning this into a bit, but I'm really good at getting deals on points that I'm going to use, and PlusGrade makes it so easy for me. I also think we've established that I was easily persuadable about buying points, but PlusGrade told us that other people do this as well, and the people who do this complete 31% more transactions. They purchase 26% more flights, and they redeem more than double the miles. So it works.
PlusGrade powers the global travel industry with its portfolio of leading ancillary revenue solutions. Trusted by over 200 airline, hospitality, cruise, passenger rail, and financial services companies, PlusGrade's platform creates new meaningful revenue streams through incredible customer experiences. By integrating loyalty solutions into the broader ancillary revenue framework, they enable travel companies to leverage ancillaries as fundamental drivers of their business. PlusGrade are the experts in running by miles programs. Reach out to them to get yours started or make your existing program drive even more revenue.
Okay, so back to Alaska and Seattle. Full disclosure, yes, that is an airline I fly a lot. And so what it affords me the opportunity to see is how it's evolved over time. And if we're comparing Alaska to JetBlue again, I think the lounge is probably a really good point of contrast. JetBlue doesn't have a lounge. They don't have a system which actually has probably prevented their ability to join a larger alliance in many ways. But Alaska's ability to garner a premium customer, which Delta also wants, has been bolstered by the fact that they've built up their infrastructure around that. And the Sky Club expansion and renovation in Seattle have been enormous too. So we see this sort of arms race in Seattle, where you didn't see that same type of product arms race between JetBlue and Delta in Boston. I think that probably played a role there. But I think,
look, here's one of my favorite stats that I pulled here. So I was looking at summer destinations for this summer, right? Delta and Alaska combined serve 106 cities from Seattle, which is staggering. But the most interesting part about this, though, only 45% of those destinations are actually served by both airlines. Alaska serves 48% all by itself. So it still has a huge footprint advantage. And Delta, by the way, Delta serves, you know, the 8% or whatever it is by itself. All of those are long haul except for Lewiston, Idaho. So congratulations, Lewiston. You are the one city that you can fly Delta in the U.S. and not Alaska from Seattle. I think Alaska just has built this tremendous footprint and huge coverage and done all of these things to increase utility that has, I mean, it's hard to top that. It's hard to top that. Now, if we compare this to Boston, it's interesting because, so Delta announced Boston as a hub in June 2019, right? That was 5 years later to the month. It had been building up a little bit before that, but when Delta announced that in 2019, JetBlue did nothing. JetBlue had been building up Boston already on its own. It doesn't look like it really changed its strategy at all. And in 2019, the only thing that it changed is that it switched its Boston service from Houston to, or from Hobby to IAH. But it didn't add new cities, didn't do anything like that. Of course, we run into the pandemic after that, so it starts to get very messy very quickly. But there was no immediate reaction of, oh, we need to respond to this. And what you've seen then is JetBlue was slow to return after the pandemic began. They put their resources elsewhere. But in Boston, the two airlines this summer combined, they'll serve 84 cities, so fewer than Seattle. Interestingly, the overlap is only 48% of markets, so it's fairly similar to what you see in Seattle. But the makeup is different of the remaining markets. Because of the remaining markets, JetBlue has about, 32% that it flies alone, but most of those are Caribbean, very leisure-heavy, leisure-focused flights. Delta has 20% of the markets that it serves that JetBlue does not. And a lot of those are these mid-sized domestic cities, former hubs, Midwest, whatever it may be, places that JetBlue is just not really good at serving. It shows a very different makeup for the Boston traveler and how they might look at something like this.
Yeah, we've mostly been talking about JetBlue's weakness, and I think it's there, but got to give Delta some credit. That is an airline that can smell weakness in a competitor. And this is something that came up this week on Delta's first quarter earnings call, because one of the analysts was asking, why are you still undersized in the mid-continent hubs, the Salt Lake City and even Atlanta, Detroit, and Minneapolis? And the airline's president, Glenn Hauenstein, said, look, this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to expand in Boston and also Los Angeles, and he was not going to let the pandemic go to waste. At the same time, JetBlue just seemed to take its eye off the ball.
No, that's absolutely true. I think what happened, the difference is Delta had built a balance sheet that it could afford to do that, and JetBlue had not. And when the pandemic hit and JetBlue freaked out and said, okay, what are we going to do? And, they put airplanes, well, they did the LAX thing, which we've already beaten to death. They did Philly, they did Raleigh-Durham, they went into Miami. They were chasing revenue. It was not a strategic move, whereas what Delta was doing was strategic. And they will see those pay dividends as we keep getting further and further away from the pandemic. Whether JetBlue just made a mistake or whether it couldn't actually afford to do it, that's what I'm not completely sure on. But either way, it made it easier for Delta, that's for sure.
Yeah, Brett, I don't know if you remember when JetBlue expanded to Los Angeles, they were spinning that as strategic. They said, we've never been able to get gate space in Los Angeles. This is our one time to expand. And even though travel demand is depressed, this is our time, right? You think it was just about revenue in LA?
Well, look, they still had Long Beach. So that was their opportunity to leave Long Beach. So it was like, hey, Long Beach sucks. Maybe this will suck less. And now we can get gates. So let's just take a swing at it. So in that sense, maybe it's strategic, but they've always been afraid to like shut down the crew base or do anything to rock the boat with employees. And, you know, I think that was not so much like a, oh, we have this space at this airport, let's make a move. It's just, oh, let's just move everything from Long Beach up here and hopefully it'll do better.
Can I throw in a wild card here? And certainly
wild card.
You guys know this world better than I do. But what role do credit cards play here? Right? I mean, like the difference in how Delta approaches Sky Miles and credit card spend versus how Alaska does it is kind of two ends of the spectrum. And how did JetBlue kind of handle that element in it against Delta or anyone else relative to maintaining loyalty? Because the Alaska credit card in Seattle is fairly ubiquitous. I remember hearing a stat a couple of years ago that some insane number of credit card swipes that happen in Seattle on a daily basis, like a really demonstrable percent of commerce that happens on an Alaska credit card. And I think that is part of the loyalty consistency piece of this as well.
Probably. I mean, Brian, you're more of the points and miles lover than I. But one thing I will say about JetBlue is I've always found the program so confusing because I feel like they change it all the time. And there's always some new tiles or mosaic or whatever. This is not my thing as much, but I think it's a harder message. So
Cones of Dunshire.
Yeah, if you go back.
Frequent Flyer edition.
We all insiders, we like to make fun of the Delta program, Sky Pesos. It's not as rewarding as maybe we'd like it to be. But the average consumer actually likes the Delta program, maybe because they don't understand it as well as we do. They don't understand. They don't get the value. Alaska's done a very good job with its program as well. I think if you're the underdog like Alaska and you're in Seattle, you have to make the program more valuable. So that's what they've done. You can get a lot of miles if you fly Alaska. On the flip side, JetBlue just hasn't done a very good job either monetizing its loyalty program or making it something that customers want to use. And these programs that are essentially cashback programs, they just don't get people jazzed about flying your airline. So that's one thing. And then perhaps more importantly, in the economics that we're in, they don't get people jazzed about swiping your credit card or applying for your credit card. And that's a big deal right now.
All right, so we've talked about the basics of what happened, how the outcomes have varied a little bit, but let's talk more about the why, because I think this is important, and I think there are some real differences here. You know, we can point to the timing. Of course, Seattle happened 5 years earlier than Boston, so there was not that COVID disruption so close to when Delta entered as a hub. That is a benefit to Seattle for Alaska to be able to react more, and I think we've talked about this to some extent. But I do think fleet is important here because when you think about Alaska and Delta, they're pretty similar, right? They're hub and spoke carriers. They have a range of narrow bodies and regional fleet, and they can serve anything within 3,000 miles, let's call it, and have overlap. And Alaska could easily respond to Delta with any move Delta made. JetBlue, though, JetBlue is more of a leisure focus, and it also doesn't have the small airplanes. I mean, the smallest airplanes it has are 100 seats and are not very efficient. But that makes it harder for JetBlue to respond and react to Delta without making more significant changes, right?
So I think you raise a really good point about fleet here, because what we had in 2013-2014 was the arrival of the first 321s, CEOs. At JetBlue. And that was a really easy way to upgauge. And what we saw actually probably over a decade before that at Alaska was the introduction of the 737-900 and then the 900ER when that became available in 2006-2007. And so the upgauging opportunities that took place at both these airlines in terms of the largest narrow bodies available came at different periods in their respective growth. And so you had then an added complexity when you had Mint arriving in 2014 for transcontinental operations, which was, again, that United PS Delta, you know, first class product back and forth. It was the Transcon 321s for American that they were competing with. So they were playing in that that premium environment. And but also still trying to hold on to their roots as a leisure carrier. And there were restrictions that, if I recall correctly, about like moving between classes and upgrades and how that would play in. So what you would otherwise have on one of the legacy carriers, you had a specific, you had to specifically buy in to Mint rather than be upgraded from the economy cabin. And then you have the 220s come along, you know, the pandemic hits shortly thereafter, on top of like an inability to like get airplanes. I mean, Boeing has, you know, prior, and Boeing obviously ran into the inability to deliver Maxes during 2019 and 2020. And then there was sort of a gush of availability of airplanes more or less for Alaska, for Max 9s. And they've grown that fleet considerably. And we obviously saw the impact of that with losing 20, 25% of your capacity when the Max 9 is grounded in January. So, you know, a lot of this has to do with OEM relationships also. I mean, JetBlue and Airbus are very close. It's hard to make a case that there aren't two entities closer than, at least before January, Alaska and Boeing, and sort of how that plays in terms of the ability to get delivery slots and just capacity in the mix here. So I think that that's a function of this also.
But that's a part of it. But I mean, timing may be a little off on some of these too, but it's more, where do you put that capacity? Like, I think, you know, the partnership angle of this is particularly interesting, because I think for Alaska in Seattle, Alaska weaponized its partnerships in a good way for Alaska, right? It tightened a lot of relationships even before Oneworld. And then it ended up going into Oneworld. It did a lot of work with that. But the American relationship for Alaska was about, okay, how can we use this to our advantage? And, you know, certainly not as deep as the NEA that JetBlue had, but still, you know, provided that that extra benefit to the elite members at Alaska when they were flying on American and getting that global network. But on the JetBlue side, the relationship with American, the NEA, Northeast Alliance, that came around to bite them, actually, because what they had to do there, they had a bunch of LaGuardia slots they had to fill. American was like, we don't know what to do with these. You go fly them. And so they had to divert resources there, and they chose to divert resources from Boston. They could have diverted them from LA or Raleigh or Philly or whatever, but they chose to divert a lot from Boston on that. So they had to fill that in, right? And then I think the idea was that, okay, well, we're going to have less in Boston, but at least American will have RJs flying to Cleveland or whatever it may be, and that will fill out our network for us and do it for us. And maybe that would have worked out okay had it not been shot down, but ultimately it did force JetBlue to put airplanes in a place that it may not have decided to do on its own. Well, it wouldn't have had access to LaGuardia slots on its own anyway. But it set them back, and it really helped create that opening for Delta to waltz in Boston. I think that's you know, that's an important part of this, the whole way that these airlines use their partnerships.
And I think to that end as well, you also had Alaska with the turboprops at Horizon and E-175s with SkyWest, which allowed them to just hit a bunch of points on the map that, you know, probably would not have been economical if you were flying a 100-seat, you know, E-190.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And distance, too. I mean, they were getting the fares. They also had the configuration. I mean, you have a 76-seat E-75. You could send those things mid-con, and they were getting a decent fare on it. Your JetBlue with a 100-seat E-90, you don't have that same premium fare capability, and that thing will not go mid-con without ruining all your costs. So you need a better fare. And really, you know, in the end, so where does this bring us? I mean, I was looking at Q4 data just to get some real numbers behind this, right? For Delta in its hubs, it has unit revenues in Q4. This is domestic, of course, domestic DB1B data, All of its hubs fell between 15.5 and 17.3 cents. And that's stage length adjusted, by the way, to 1,000 miles. The lowest end there was 15.5 was Salt Lake, LaGuardia at 17.3. Boston just below that at 17.1. Stellar performance. And then there's Seattle, which sits down at 12.3. Significantly different than any other hub, much lower. So it continues to be a struggle. And I think part of that may very well be part of Alaska's strategy. You know, Alaska has lower unit costs than Delta. So if Alaska keeps fares lower, it puts more pressure on Delta. You know, they kind of do their own thing. And I think that's part of the strategy. But meanwhile, in Boston, Delta seems to be crushing it these days and doing really well there. And, you know, now we have a new JetBlue management and who knows what their strategy will be. But certainly this is an area that needs a lot more attention.
Brett, we have Delta seat share in Boston at about 28% compared to JetBlue's 25%. It's only a 3-point difference, something that JetBlue can make up. But do you expect over time that Delta is actually going to add more and more capacity there and try to get that seat share up way above 28%?
If their numbers keep coming back the way they are so far, then why wouldn't they? It seems like a good place to add capacity if you can do well there. I think Seattle is the bigger question. Is there a reason that they want to keep trying there and pouring more capacity in there? If I'm looking at Boston, I'm thinking, man, this is doing great. We should be doing more here because there's more opportunity. All right, I think we've had a detailed and dense discussion today, but there's much more story to be told here. I think the interesting part of this is you see two different kinds of airlines responding in different ways to Delta going into markets and having different outcomes. And, you know, it'll make a good case study someday.
You've been listening to The Air Show. And once again, thanks for following the show and welcoming it into your podcast feeds. Please recommend the podcast to your colleagues and anyone in the industry who you think would find it valuable.
If you have suggestions or questions for us, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, go to our website, theairshowpodcast.com, to get in touch.
Thanks to our sponsor, PlusGrade. The Air Show is produced and edited by Sarah Fay. Our theme music is by Joshua Mosier. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.